All right, I can tell that I'm on. Thank you, Bob, for inviting me and for the opportunity to be with you this morning. I help out over at Bishop Diego High School. This is something that just started this year, this semester, a few weeks ago. And I say Mass. I go there one day a week, and I say Mass while I'm there. And then some of the teachers will invite me to come into the classroom to address the student on one topic or another. I was on the phone with my sister yesterday, and I told her about my going over there, and she said, well, what are some of the things that they want you to have had you talk about? And I said, well, for instance, last Friday, I went to six classes, four of which I had been asked, the theology room, if I would give a short introduction to centering prayer and lead the students in a short 7-minute centering prayer experience. Now, isn't that neat? Yeah, for high school students. And I really commended them. So that was four. And the other two was the English class. And let me read to you what the English teacher had asked me to address. And this is what I was sharing with my sister. What I thought would be, this is in reference to Dostoevsky's book, Crime and Punishment. What I thought would be useful for students to hear from you, the idea of how the ego and sense of superiority, or being outside the law, what the consequences can be spiritually, not just psychologically or philosophically. I was thinking 10 minutes. That's what she said. So I shared with my sister four classrooms of going over a centering prayer and two classes discussing the role of the ego in Dostoevsky's crime and punishment. Centering prayer is a form of prayer taught by Thomas Keating properly, and it's a form of meditation and contemplation. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about that today. It's wonderful. Well, I told this to my sister. She's my older sister. Much, much older. And there was a pause, and she said, Patrick, there is a reason why your eyes are brown. So I did not dare tell her that I was going to be discussing today natural mysticism, the unity of all things, contemplation as a participation in a larger knowing and full consciousness. I thought if I were to have shared that with her, she would send somebody after me to let the people of Santa Barbara know that there's a great imposter running around. And it's exactly how I felt when I read Richard Rohr, a few of his books, and listened to some of his recordings and whatnot. Richard Rohr can be very accessible, very simple to read, and very profound. That wasn't my experience with this book. And I could, I don't know what your experience, maybe you're having the same. And what that means is we just have to chew a little longer to kind of see if we can understand some of what's going on. But I do, what I did plug into And I think where he goes with much of his writing is in the area of the movement of transformation. He's really all about transformation, and that is a topic that I don't think we can talk enough about. It is what the Christian call is about. It's about our personal transformation. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't limit that to Christian call at all. That's the call of spirituality, is a call to transformation. So what I thought I would be, and something that I feel much more comfortable with than discussing the nature of mysticism, although I'd love to give that a shot. But as I say, I think maybe if we strip away the various words, we all kind of are talking about the same thing. So we're okay with that. Is what my own spiritual journey and understanding has been in my life. There is a book, and I was just talking about this with Tom. And I'm not sure if I think Bob and I had talked about it too. There's a book that I heartily recommend and would love to come and share with you on as well. Written by the Trappist monk Thomas Keating. And I mentioned Thomas Keating as one who teaches a centering prayer. And centering prayer is a very simple form of we can call it meditation, but he would call it more kind of pre-contemplative prayer. Now, those are big words, and they can, as soon as I hear the word contemplation, I'm gone. You know, that's for people in monasteries and convents and, you know, Patrick, contemplation, I don't think so. But, of course, that's because my ideas are not very accurate. And he has this wonderful form of prayer that involves just sitting. All one needs is a chair and to be able to sit down in it. That's it. And to close one's eyes and just sit. I liken it to those times when you have sat on a couch or on a bench with someone that you're close to and you love very much, and who you know and who knows you very much, and you have those experiences of just sitting, and you're not talking, you're not solving, you're not discussing, you're just sitting. And even in the just sitting together, there is much communication going on. It's not verbal. It's just in presence. The very act of being present to one another is a profound way that we have of communicating with one another. And centering prayer is just sitting with God, just sitting. And what happens when we sit is that thoughts start racing through our heads. And that's fine. What Thomas suggests is when we find that we are engaging in those thoughts, let's see, now I have to get gas after I'm through here. Now, where should I go? That gas station down at the other corner has better price. That's engaging in the thoughts. And when we realize we've engaged in the thoughts, we simply repeat a sacred word. And it's not sacred in and of itself, but it's sacred in that it represents our consent to God's presence and action in our lives. And so when I find that my phrase is I am, that when I find my thoughts and myself engaging in those thoughts, I simply repeat I am to myself very gently. Thomas Keating says, as gently as laying a feather on a pillow. Very gently. And pretty soon I disengage with that thought. And in doing so, I have once again given my consent to God's presence and action within my life. And 5 seconds later, there's another stream of thoughts that come along. And then I have to catch myself. There was a nun that he had given a workshop to that came up to him and said, "Father Keating, that was wonderful, but I can't do it." He said, "Well, what's the problem, sister?" "Well, in that 20-minute period, I must have had 1,000 thoughts." And Thomas Keating smiled and said, "Isn't that wonderful, sister? 1,000 times you got to go back to God." Wasn't that a wonderful perspective? And so it's not about... Anyway, that's what Thomas Keating has been known for. And people in 12-step programs... I've been in AA since 1980. Well, I got sober in 1983 and got active in AA in 1986. I was a little slow to get the message. But the 11th step is sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. That's the 11th step of the 12-step program. Well, people that in those 12-step programs that heard about centering prayer thought, what a wonderful way to practice our 11th step. Eventually, asked Thomas Keating to work with them and help them with that, and he became one who very much appreciates 12-step spirituality. And there was a book written now that's called Divine Therapy and Addiction, which is by and far the finest, most engaging book on spirituality that I have ever read. And I've read it many times over. I have a similar group that come up to St. Mary's on Thursday morning. They were up there this morning, about a dozen, 15, 20 guys from town, AA fellows. We do a 20-minute meditation at 7:30, and then at 8 o'clock we do an hour of 12-step spirituality-related reading. And we've been doing that for several years. We read that Keating's book 3 times. We've read no other book more than once. We read that book 3 times. The first 2 times were right back-to-back. And then we decided to read a couple of other books, and then we went back to Keating's book. Currently, there's two or three guys that come up to St. Mary's, like my friend Connor comes up on Monday nights, and we read a chapter of the book or a few pages of the book and discuss it. And there's been 3 or 4 guys that I've done that with. So it's a book that I'm constantly involved with. And he talks about what the originating condition of the human being is. And that was a very long introduction to where I think we're going and Richard Rohr has been talking about. So if you'll bear with me, what Thomas Keating, the first step in a 12-step program is we admitted we are powerless over, like in AA we would say, alcohol. It could be any number of things, as you know. However, the second part of step one, which is the most important, and our life is unmanageable. Now, why our life is unmanageable is what Thomas Keating does such a masterful job of explaining. And what he says is that when we are born, God gives to us the gifts of some instincts that are very necessary for us to survive. And basically, there are 4 instincts. One, the instinct toward the need to be approved, accepted, esteemed. As you know, young children need, literally need, to be hugged and to be loved. That's necessary for survival. Is for a child to be hugged and loved, to have that instinct gratified. Another instinct is the sense of safety and security. I'm safe. I'm safe. Absent of any dire threat. And you know, and I think of these kids in all these various areas of the world that just don't have that. And what that does, because that's an essential component to being well, is for a child to experience safety and security. And when they don't, it does damage that lasts a lifetime. So that's the second. And the third instinct always makes me smile. Power and control. Anybody that's ever been around a two-year-old gets that. They're in charge. They're in charge. But again, it's that having, perhaps to have the first two instincts met, there's a sense that I've got to manage this environment and these crazy adults that are in my life. Gosh, they constantly need my attention. So that they'll get it right. And the fourth instinct is one that we don't talk too much about, and that is identification with one's group. And this really comes into play a little later on, but for instance, the first group is family. I identify with my family, might identify with my church, might identify with my school, a little later on maybe a sports team, perhaps eventually a political party or ideology. And so there's the identification with group. To the extent that if the group is threatened, I am threatened. I feel a sense of being threatened, and so I go on the defensive. Now, God gave us these instincts so that we survive. Everybody has them. Children absolutely have to have them in order to survive. Now, for the child, it's the gratification of those instincts that is their only frame of reference for what happiness is. They don't know any, they don't have any kind of lofty idea of happiness. Give me that ice cream when I want it. That's happiness. Getting my instincts gratified. Being hugged. Being safe. My happiness depends upon seeing to it that these needs that I have are gratified, are met. That is my happiness. On the contrary, every time I experience those needs not being met, then there's afflicted emotions that go off, fear and anger, rage sometimes. And that is perfectly normal in children. What the maturation and the movement toward contemplative life or the spiritual, the movement toward spiritual life is a movement from that very kind of self-centered, self-referencing attitude in life to an other-centered way of relating to the world. The first condition, everything's about me. If you are in my life, your job is to see to it that I'm okay and happy, loved, secure, and in charge. That's your job. We hear this phrase, it's all about me. And that's exactly all right. Now, if I'm 45 years old and my life is still all about me and your job still is to accept and approve and esteem me and be sure that you let me know that and that you don't threaten me in any way, and I'm still in charge of your life, so don't you try and mess with mine. If that is still where I'm looking for and needing to find my happiness, and I'm 45 years old, I've got a big problem. And we've all had that problem, haven't we? If I'm 65 years old and I'm still doing that, well, I still have a big problem. And to the extent that we are living our life out of that need to gratify those instincts, to that extent, I cannot be at rest. I cannot be at rest. This is a condition that all human beings suffer from. And we might live and die and always suffer from that. But hopefully, somewhere along the line, it begins to shift. And this is what constitutes the spiritual growth that Richard Rohr talks so well about. It's the shift from that self-centered, self-referencing kind of way of being to finding my happiness by being other-centered, and especially in the doing of the will of God. This is where the happiness is to be found. It's a kind of happiness that I like to refer to as soul-deep joy. Not the ephemeral happiness that, you know, we experience that's very transitory. But rather that soul-deep joy in deep waters. If you are at the bottom of a very deep lake, for instance, hopefully you'll have gear on so you can breathe. If you're at the bottom, what you would sense is calm. There could be a storm raging on the surface, but by and large, the deep waters remain calm. And that's how I think of this soul deep joy. It's a calmness deep within that is unaffected, by and large, by whatever in the world chaos is going on in the surface. Does that make sense? And we can't achieve that soul deep joy by always running around trying to get our instincts gratified. It just won't happen. In a 12-step program, it's amazing to me. Being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous has been the greatest gift to my spiritual life ever. It's the last place I would have gone. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I just enjoyed drinking. I enjoyed drinking a lot, actually. And I did what I enjoyed a lot. Of course, it didn't work for me. I had the disease, didn't know I had the disease. I had the disease, and it's a physiological disease. It's an allergy, really, to alcohol. And rather than breaking out in a rash, the effect of alcohol in the body of someone who has this disease is that enzymes are created in the brain as a result of interacting with the alcohol substance. Enzymes, a substance is produced in the brain called tetrahydroisoquinoline, or THIQ. And that stays in the brain, and that's a highly addictive substance. It doesn't happen in the brains of someone who doesn't have this disease. But there's a portion of the population that has this particular allergy, and it's what happens when they ingest alcohol. It's purely a physiological condition. It's not a moral condition. It's not, you know, a matter of being irresponsible or any of the things we usually attribute to alcoholism. It's simply a physiological condition. Instead of breaking out in a rash, I have another drink. And that's the manifestation of this. So I didn't know I had that. So I just drank like everybody else did. Except I drank a lot more than everybody else did and for a lot longer period of time. When everybody else was going off to bed or leaving the party, I was just getting started. Well, that went on for about 5 years, or about 7 years after ordination. And finally one night, my boss, our provincial, ended up in the living room with me, and he said, "Patrick, you know, I've been a little concerned about you. You don't seem to be living up to your potential," et cetera. You know that talk. So I admitted to him that I had been a little depressed lately. And he said, "Well, if there's anything we can do, let me know." And he left. And I sat there in my easy chair with my glass of scotch in my hand. Now, those of you who don't know, you see us there in that chair with our glass of scotch in our hand. And, you know, we're kind of... you think we're drunk. What's going on is that the cosmos has opened up to us. And we are privileged to have the secrets of the cosmos revealed to us. That's what's really happening, you know. So next time you see somebody in that condition, I want you to know what's going on. So, the secrets of the cosmos are being revealed. Unfortunately, they're not going to ever remember what those secrets were. So there I was, having the secrets of the cosmos open, revealed to me. And all of a sudden, there was one that got revealed. You are an alcoholic and you need help. Bang! Right in my face. I worked with the police department at the time, and I knew what happened to people like me. So I got up and went into the pastor's room and said, "I'm an alcoholic, I need help." We don't do that sort of thing. I understand today that was just pure grace, and I mean that. That was just pure grace. Probably went unresisted because I was intoxicated. That was pure grace at work, and the pastor said, "Well, we'll give you help in the morning." I woke up the next morning, and sitting on the foot of my bed was an alcohol intervention specialist. I woke up and I knew who he was and knew what he did. I woke up and saw him there and thought, "Oh, no." I remembered what I had done the night before. That's the stupidest thing I'd ever done. I'd done some really stupid things under the influence, but that took the cake. So I began to explain to him that I had been overreacting, that I had been a little depressed lately, but I thanked him very sincerely for his concern. And I even made the very solemn promise, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do." When you hear an alcoholic say that, just turn the switch off. "I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to give this drinking business some very serious thought." And he didn't move. He just sat there. I was getting very thirsty. I said, do you mind if I have a beer? He said, no. And I pulled a warm beer out from under the bed and opened it and started drinking it, trying to convince him I didn't need his help. I don't understand why, but I lost the argument. So that's how I went into a treatment center that afternoon. And that warm beer, sad to say, was the last drink of my life. I only say sad to say because I could have done so much better with my last drink. I didn't need to go to AA because, after all I really needed to do was not drink. I got that. They taught me about that allergy. I got it. If I had a peanut allergy, I'd know, okay, I can't have peanuts. So that, you know, I got it. But for heaven's sakes, going to AA wasn't necessary. So I did not follow their recommendation that I get involved in AA for a couple of years. And finally, I went on a retreat for priests that were alcoholics. I met a couple in Phoenix where I was working and went on a retreat with them. And mentioned that I didn't go to AA. No, I don't go. And one of the priests went for a walk with me and told me his story. And the result of his story was that he was covered in a body bag, zipped and tagged. Now, a nurse saw some movement underneath the body inside and called the doctor, who was having martinis out in his car. And the doctor came in and operated on him and saved his life. They both ended up in AA. He met the doctor later on who told him what was going on with him. So John told me that story, and he said, Patrick, that's what had to happen to me. It doesn't have to happen to you. And I thought, you know, I don't want that to happen to me. And so I wandered into my first meeting of AA, And I heard them talking about God and prayer and meditation and all those spiritual things, and thought, what in the world am I having to sit here and listen to people like this tell me about God? After all, I have a master's of divinity. I've got a degree in God, for heaven's sakes. These people surely don't. It took me a good while to finally get well enough to begin to listen. And then I did begin to listen. And I will remember the night that the man that I admired was talking, and he talked about how he gets up in the morning and he prays. And he prays for knowledge of God's will and the power to carry that out. And how as he goes through the day and things come up, he always remembers to ask, what is your will, Lord? What is your will? Save me from being angry. What is your will? And when he goes to bed at night, he reviews his day. And when he was wrong, he looks at that and asks for God's help for the next time. And I sat there and I thought, my goodness. That's what they were teaching us in the seminary to do. I haven't done it in years. He actually does this. He's not a priest. He's not a seminarian. He's just an alcoholic. Huh. Imagine that. And the door cracked open, finally, for me. What I found is that condition opened the door eventually to my beginning to realize my powerlessness, not just over alcohol, but over my life as I described. I could see how my life was run by my wanting to have my instincts gratified. I wanted people to think well of me. Oh my goodness gracious, if I wanted you to think well of me, what I wouldn't do to make that happen. And the frustration and the rage I would go into inside, never on the outside, because then you'd know me. Can't have you knowing me. But I'd be going on the inside. And I could see all of this at work in my life eventually. Step two is, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. Huh. I have all this craziness going on in my life that I've been trying to manage all of this time. I use a very powerful tool to manage the chaos in my life. It's called resolution. I make a resolution. And how does that work for you? It doesn't. But it's the only tool I ever had. And finally I got that there's a power greater than myself. Father got. Father was taught by those alcoholics who don't know anything. Father was taught that there's a power greater than him who could restore him to sanity. Huh. And I went on to the next step. I made a decision then I was going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And this is precisely what Richard Rohr gets to. Is that finally in our life, we give up having to be in control. We give up having to try and fix ourselves. I've spent my whole life trying to fix myself. Could never, ever, ever do it. So finally, and you know, our religious upbringings supports that fallacy. That, well, if you've got something wrong, deal with it. You know, make a resolution. try harder. Thomas Keating has a wonderful line in the book I recommended, and he says, effort in the spiritual life is chiefly about finding out it doesn't work. Isn't that wonderful? Effort in the spiritual life is chiefly about finding out it doesn't work. What I came to realize then is that my job in this world isn't to make myself better. It's not even to get better. Now, I'm having to do a lot of switching of how I thought life should be and my life should be and how the spiritual life should be. I had to get to a whole new kind of level. And that's precisely the transformation that Rohr is talking about. That transformation of I'm in charge and it's up to me to fix myself and to make myself better. And so I'll adopt this practice and I'll read this book and I'll do that and I won't do this. And that should do the trick. Except it doesn't. Finally, to surrender and say, ah, this is all God's job in my life. I have now understood that I have only, when I get up in the morning, that my job is to say, good morning, God. What would you like for me to do today? In one way or the other. What's my job? What do you want me to do today? Leave behind Patrick's agendas. The dying to self that Rohr talked about is precisely that, leaving behind our agendas and our egos and having life be all about me and simply saying, what is your will for me today? That's it. How, according to your will you have me be of service to others? It's that movement from self-centered, self-referencing to other-centered, service-referencing. How can I be of help to someone else? That's all God wants for me to be. With all of my sins intact, I'm standing here before you as a man with sin. But that doesn't seem to bother God in the least. Because what God wants me to be doing right here and right now, for at least 10 more minutes, is to be yakking. Period. God does not want me to be working on making Patrick better. He wants me to be of service. And here's what I've understood about that. That if that is my focus, God will see to it that I have absolutely everything I need to have to do what God wants me to be doing. God wants me to be doing this morning. I had everything that God knew that I would need to have to be standing here doing this morning. Did not need anything other than what God gave to me today, right here, right now, to be doing this, which is God's will. Really? You mean I don't need that new iPhone 6S? Can I have it anyway? I think God approves of Apple products. I don't know. See, it helps me know what time it is. Doesn't that remove, when we get that, that when my life finally has been merged into the will of God, as Roar talks about, it frees. What a freeing. All that worry that goes into, I don't have what I need, disappears. It dissolves. I may not have what I need to do what I want, to have life be the way I want it to be. That's for sure. But if my life is not about Patrick, but about doing the will of God in service of others, I'll never have to worry about not having what God knows that I need. Never, ever, 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 ever. I'll never have to worry about that. So if I find myself worrying about what I don't have, well, then that's a good tip off. Yeah. You're being about Patrick. Which is all right. It's just one of those sins that I have. And speaking of sins, here's another thing that I've realized. How much of our life, how is this for a conversation that perhaps at some time or another in your life you've experienced? I'm not the way I'm supposed to be right now. Have you, any of you ever felt that way? Like within the last 10 minutes? I am not the way I'm supposed to. You know, the trap with reading books like this, and I'm serious, the trap we can easily fall into, he has some wonderful, wonderful descriptions of being a contemplative kind of person. The being at one with nature and all of that, one with other people. I am one with other people until they get in front of me. Or behind me, depending upon how fast they're going. And thinking, oh, this is the way I'm supposed to be. Which is a way of saying, I'm not the way I'm supposed to be right now. I believe that is the great lie. That is the great lie. I am not the way I'm supposed to be right now. That conversation will keep us forever dissatisfied with who we are. We're never going to be right. Never going to be right. What a shame to live and die always feeling like there's something wrong with me. Huh? That's not God's will for us. That's not God's will for us. What God's will for us is that we be embracing ourselves. not being dissatisfied with ourselves. Is it good for me to know what areas of my life still need growth? Absolutely. Really important for me to know that. But to be unhappy and dissatisfied with myself as a result, not God's will. So, when I get up in the morning and I pray and I ask God, you know, what is your will for me today? Here's the other truth. One, I will have all that God knows that I need to have. That's one. Here's the second one. I will be exactly the way God needs for me to be doing God's will. I will be exactly the way God needs for me to be doing God's will. I don't need to be one bit different. Right here, right now, to be doing God's will. With all of my sins. Wow! That's different, isn't it? That's a different way of looking at it. I thought I was supposed to be unhappy about all those things that are wrong with me. And here's another realization. I would not be... I don't know what Bob's reasoning was. But whether he knew it or not, he didn't ask me to come and talk here today because he admired my virtue. Where are you, Bob? Oh, he's left already. He got it. Oh, that was a mistake. We don't relate to one another through our... Oh, hi. I was taking your name in vain, but that's all right. Oh, that's right. When somebody calls me up and say, Patrick, do you have time? Can we get together and talk? Meet down at the coffee shop? They're not asking me to do that because of my virtue, of all the sins that I've conquered. What attracts them to me to them, is, well, Patrick's pretty screwed up. Yet, he seems to be okay. I'm screwed up and I want to be okay. So, maybe I'll find out. I went for a walk with one of my brothers many, many years ago. And he also was a candidate for the program, but didn't want to go. He was going to use his men's Bible fellowship to be the group to keep him sober. And we were talking about that. And we were walking along, and he said, Patrick, why should I go and hang out with all these guys that have screwed their life up? And I said, because they've screwed their life up. And the light bulb went off. Well, of course, who are you going to go to? Those that have screwed their life up. So, you see, this is all to say that what we sometimes see in ourselves as being bad or wrong may in fact be exactly what God needs to have in us to reach out and be able to help somebody. In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, there's this line which just, oh my God, there's this line that says, cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have. With it, you can avert death and misery for others. Isn't that something? Dark past that we're so ashamed of and want to hide and, oh my God, and want to have in the closet. is the greatest possession we have. That's the gift I have to give to others, is my dark past, not my accomplishment of virtue. It's my dark past. That's the gift I have to offer to others. So this notion of the spiritual life, for me, in my journey, has kind of upended everything that I thought it was supposed to be. I thought I was supposed to get as good as I could possibly get, and chiefly by my own efforts, and oh well, if I have to ask God for a little bit of help, fine, but I'm not to do that any more than necessary. And the whole notion of just surrendering and letting God do the fixing. I have this image, you probably had that same experience, you know, when mom's in the kitchen cooking dinner and little Patrick comes in and Patrick wants to help. Mommy, can I help? Mommy doesn't need my help. But mommy is being very nice and says, oh, sweetheart, thank you, thank you. Could you count the number of napkins on the table for me? Okay, mommy. One. And while Patrick is counting the napkins, mom's fixing the dinner. And this is kind of the image I have with, if I want to, you know, going into the kitchen and saying to God, God, you need any help fixing me? Well, God may say, thank you, Patrick, yes. Could maybe you work a little bit on how about not being quite as lazy? Okay, why don't you go work on that? And, okay, I'm going to work on not being so lazy. And while I'm working on not being so lazy, God's doing what God knows needs to be done in Patrick, which has got nothing to do with being lazy. That's just to keep Patrick occupied and out of the way. So my whole notion of how all of this worked has changed. But along with that change has just been a wonderful freedom. And as I have come to accept that, okay, I can love and embrace Patrick just the way Patrick is, with all of the flaws, with all of the sins, all the how screwed up we are. As I learn that, and I encounter your need for grace, your need for healing, I'm no longer needing to point my finger at you and say, look at how they are. They, other than me, they are. I'm looking and saying, look how we are. And God has granted me so many, many graces in my life. And so, God, I pray, grants the other so many graces in their life. And be as patient with God healing them as I have to be patient with God healing me. Last night, I was with my home group, the Junkyard Dogs. That's what we're called. And so here's a young kid who is, you know, got a little bit of time now, sober. Not somebody that if you were to see on the street, you would go up to for any kind of spiritual insight. And this is what he's saying. He said, I realized how I had to ask God to forgive me for all the mistakes I've made in my past. But then I'd turn around and I would absolutely go ballistic when I ran into the stuff that other people were doing. And then it finally occurred to me, how can I ask God to forgive me when I am unwilling to forgive them? Now here's a kid off the streets, tattooed, earringed, with that profound spiritual insight. You see, transformation has been happening in his life. He never say that. He probably figured you'd get arrested if anybody knew transformation was going on. but it was there happening. So, it's 11 o'clock, and that's just where I've come to today, in terms of what this the whole spiritual life thing is all about. Maybe I'll end with another quote from Thomas Keating, and he said, "To try harder is rarely good advice. To trust more is always good advice." Huh? Thank you. Thank you.